Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. It is Monday morning, and it is Wake Up with Revly. You know, one of the things that... Hang on one second. For some reason, my Do Not Disturb is not kicking in. All right. One thing I thought we would talk a little bit about today . Good morning.
Hello.
One thing I'd like to do before we start is offer our prayers and wishes for our military base in Syria. I don't know if you've heard or not yet, but our military base in Syria was under attack yesterday or last night.
I didn't hear that.
Apparently, drones and missiles were coming from Iraq and aiming at our military base in Syria. They haven't had a word about casualties or anything like that yet, or anything that's going on. It's just... information's just not all there yet, so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the government's probably going to keep that hush hush.
Well, that and the fact that it has nothing to do with Israel and, you know, that
right.
Whole thing. And it shows, you know, how we screwed up. Yeah, it was an Iraqi military group that's taking credit for it.
That doesn't surprise me.
As soon as we get more information, y'all get more information.
Sounds like a plan.
You know, so yesterday at church, we talked about Psalm 23.
Mm-hmm.
And what was interesting is that... my pastor brought it up in a different way. You know, a lot of people say it was written by King David and, you know, and written in first person. But she brought up a good analogy and a different way of looking at it.
Mm-hmm.
So King David was a shepherd at that time. And he wasn't always the most God-abiding man. He was, you know, the core of screw up, do everything wrong, apologize, amend your ways. And, you know, in my eyes, King David was the role of forgiveness. But she brought up a theory that Psalm 23 was written in the eyes of the sheep.
Well, that's interesting.
And so for those, And so for people who don't know Psalm 23, it's a lot of times talked about as a funeral psalm. But, you know, it's the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me lay down on green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. He restores my soul. He leads me in the paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Even though he walks through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod, your staff, they comfort me. You prepare the table before me in the presence of my enemies, and you anoint my head with oil. My cup overflows. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I dwell in the house of the Lord forever. You know, when you look at it, as a sheep's perspective, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. So wolves and prey, they're calm. Those sheep are calm because King David, the shepherd, is there to protect them. When you walk through the valley of the shadow of death, you know, for a sheep, the pasture is the shadow of death. You know, there's prey, there's, you know, things that'll get them everywhere. You know, your rod and staff, they comfort me. Shepherds carry that rod and staff to help protect the sheep. And a lot of times, shepherds lived out in the fields. So as you prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies, you know, they're eating usually two meals out, if not all meals, out in the environment with your sheep.
But aren't we the sheep of the Lord?
We are.
And the king is the shepherd. That's the way I always looked at it. I mean, but I whenever I was growing up, first part said, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. Why won't I want? You know. But that meant I won't be in need. Because you will lead me to greener pastures. And in our hectic lives, doesn't he say, be still and know that I am God?
Yes.
So he leads us beside still waters. Right?
Correct.
I mean, that's just the way I've always looked at it, but looking at it from the sheep's point of view, that's interesting. That's a different way of looking at it, I'll tell you. I never looked at it that way.
I never did either. You know, in the vast expanse of the rolling hills where the grass sways gently in the breeze, you find contentment. The shepherd watches over me diligently, ensuring that I lack for nothing. His presence fills me with peace, and I trust in his provision. He makes me lay down in green pastures. When the sun beats down upon the fields and exhaustion threatens to overwhelm me, my shepherd leads me to rest in lush pastures. The softness of the grass beneath me soothes my weary limbs, and I am grateful for his care. He leads me beside still waters. Besides the tranquil streams where the water flows gently, I find refreshment. My shepherd guides me to these calm waters where I drink deeply and I am renewed in. In his presence, there is tranquility and solace. He restores my soul. In the moment of weariness and distress, my shepherd lifts me up and restores my strength. His gentle touch comforts me, and his love rejuvenates my spirit. In his care, I find healing and restoration. He leads me in a path of righteousness for his name's sake. Now, when you look at it that way, we're the sheep.
Mm-hmm.
And God's the shepherd. And then how encompasses how we are all one. You know, there's really not much difference between us and animals. In the sense of what we're made of.
Hey. We're all dirt.
You know, with every step I take, my shepherd guides me along the path of righteousness. His wisdom illuminates the way before me, and I follow eagerly, knowing that his guidance is true. In his footsteps, I find direction and purpose. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and staff, they comfort me. In the darkest valleys, their shadow looms large, and the fear threatens to engulf me. I am not alone. My shepherd walks beside me, his rod and staff, source of comfort and protection. With him by my side, I am unafraid, for his presence is my strength. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup overflows. And when you look at it in the sheep's perspective, you know, they used to put oil on sheep to help with the flies and stuff like that. I just thought it was a different perspective.
Yeah, it is. I like that.
You know, goodness and mercy are my constant companions. Well, a shepherd's always with the sheep. You don't leave them alone. God's always with you. You know, it's kind of like a little flip on it. You know, we always look at God as this almighty thing somewhere in the heavens. And this, looking at it this way, it puts him, you know, right there with you. You know, when my journey on this earth is complete, I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. And this term, dwell, means live. You know, in the presence of my shepherd, where he knows no end.
Yeah, that's good. What else has been going on?
Yesterday was International Autism Awareness Day.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've been speaking at different conferences and seminars and different departments all month long. But, you know, so many people focus with kids when they're diagnosed as broken. And they figure, sit there, on what they can do to make them like everybody else. And we forget that these are kids born a specific way for a reason. And what's really interesting, and I've talked about this a lot, is that these kids live in a scientific world. But the one thing they understand so well, and it's the coolest thing, because I see this with my kids all the time too, is they have a deep understanding of faith, the Bible, and God. And I truly believe part of the reason why there's more cases of it, and it's really not, it's just that they've changed the way that we look at it, but I truly believe these kids are born for a reason, and I really believe they're born, if we leave them alone to the point that we let them be who they are and accept them for who they are and give them that voice to talk and speak, it's going to change the way we look at the world. And we've got kids as young as six, seven years old that are speaking out, and it's so cool. They actually explain the Big Bang Theory, and they explain it in a way that proves the existence of God. These kids can take the science world and combine them with faith and show how science proves the existence of God. If
that's
they're
cool.
Given that voice and allowed to speak and given that attention, it could really change how we look at society instead of being that separation of faith and science, turn into being one.
It's supposed to be one.
Correct. But somewhere down that road, we've, you know, in the 1800s into the, you know, 1900s, now into the 2000s, we've developed this world that science is one, faith is another. And you have to not believe in God to be able to be a scientist.
And yet science is what?
All theories?
Theories, right. Not fact.
No
one person can see something totally different than the next person.
You know, in the world of psychology, it's blowing my mind right now with the technology finally catching up. That what our psychologists and therapists from like the late 1800s, even before, have ran on theories of observation. They didn't have the technology to prove it as fact. You know, cells are, you know, this and, you know, all these things that now, hundreds of years later, they're proving these theories as fact by that, such as Bruce Lipton, for instance, in the 40s, started coming up with this theory because it used to believe that your cells in your brain are different than the cells in your foot. And he was running off the theory of, no, all your cells are the same. It's a whole, what each cell is an imprint of what's in your whole body, your thoughts, your feelings, your makeup, everything is all in each cell. Well, now they're proving that to be true. You know, each cell, your DNA is all the same in your whole entire body. Now, all these things that they figured out just by being smart and observing and listening and shutting up is now being proven to be true in a way. And we don't give our ancestors the credit they deserve.
True. I always looked at it as each cell is a galaxy unto itself.
Yeah.
Miniaturized.
Yeah.
Because every galaxy in the universe is different.
Mm-hmm.
They're not the same, but they are galaxies. And they're unto, you know, they're unto themselves, really. Just like ourselves. But they all work in harmony together.
No, you look at it in that perspective, each person is their own galaxy.
Right. With galaxies within.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's where I have a hard time when they're talking about, like, the vaccines and the RNA vaccines. It's like we're changing something that we have no understanding what we're changing. And when God made us, our bodies will heal itself.
Yeah.
Now, if we start messing with the system that is ran perfectly for how many years, what's the repercussions? Because you can't just change one thing. Our bodies are so intricate. And the cool, it's kind of interesting. And I think it's kind of cool because I'm kind of one of them people. But they have found when they do organ transplants, that individuals, this is a big reason why people on death row cannot donate organs. People, bad people in prisons cannot donate their organs. As they've found that people have actually adapted that organ's personality, that person that had that organ's personality.
Mm-hmm.
It used to be a fear or a thought. Now they're proving that to be true. So really, when you think about it, we're changing something God created to make ourselves what? Like God? And where are all the repercussions going down with that? You know, what they're finding out is, you know, you can go in and have a baby and you can have it, you know, genetically altered to have not have all these issues. and they're finding out there's other issues they come up with down the road. We cannot create life out of a test tube. We can help it, you know, taking parts of a girl and parts of a boy and putting them together as they are, but we can't create life on our own. And really, with this, you know, families picking the babies and picking out the sex, and they're messing with the DNA and, you know, sequencing and all that crap. We've seen such a high rise of crimes and psychopathic behaviors in children. I really want to know if there's been a study done to see the percentage of these children born naturally or if they were test tube babies.
I don't know if that would be in the Freedom of Information or if that is still classified.
Or if they've even bothered to do a study on it yet.
That's true.
Because we're having...
Go ahead.
We've had an alarming rate of children from a very young age turning into having psychopathic tendencies that we've never seen before. You know, kids who are very unemotional. And it's not because they're autistic, because they're not. And children lacking empathy from a very young age.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not always the parents' fault.
Right. I agree with that.
Well, because, you know, they have found back in the 80s and 90s, it started out in the late 60s, early 70s, this therapist decided to run with this theory, and it turned into a big thing about how the more you hold a child, the more you play with them, they become spoiled. You know, we self-soothe them. We let them cry themselves to sleep. And it became a wave during when women started going to work so that moms weren't up all night with the baby and could sleep and go to work. And what they've found is that kids who are self-soothed, especially at a very young age, that part of their brain, that emotional aspect of their brain and compassion doesn't grow at the rate it should. It takes a lot longer because they're not taught that. They're not shown that emotion and that love. And it also, part of the reason why some of these kids don't, they develop that abandonment issues because they don't get that securing and need to or want to be, you know, held and played with and knowing that if they cry, they'll be taken care of. You know, how many parents just put their kids, propped up a bottle and threw in front of a TV set?
Yeah. You know?
I just wonder how much of a correlation this is and with our kids, the way they are, how much of it has to do with the different things we're doing. One, you know, doing that, but also with the changing of the DNA.
There's definitely a lot of changes in the DNA. Have you seen those commercials for the TICU and other so-called helps medications for anxiety and breathing? They got a list of side effects a mile long. I don't want that. And what's it doing to the DNA?
Yeah.
And then the kids are put on medication and stuff, and given a game pod or something. So, you know. My grandson was helping me with my iPhone whenever he was basically 4. I said, how the heck do you know this?
You know, when you bring that up, I always found it interesting. You know, originally when it came to anxiety and depression, they said it was a hormonal imbalance in the brain. And they said it was because of low serotonin levels. That was the narrative. So our antidepressants, our anti-anxiety meds, all targeted serotonin levels, right?
Right. Yep.
Now, go and find the original research and the original study to link the two together. There isn't one. The narrative was actually created by Big Pharma.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't till 2022 that the National Institute of Health a therapist, Moncrief, out of the UK, I believe, did a study and countered that. Because one, you can't check serotonin levels and all the levels of hormones in your brain while you're alive. It's physically impossible because you got to cut in your brain. You can't cut in your brain and still be alive. And two, they have found that you actually have more serotonin levels in your gut than you do in your brain.
Yeah, I've heard that one.
But yet, you know, this big study in London and all these things were done, and it's not, they're still pushing the serotonin levels, which is why, you know, when you're on antidepressants, they base you out, they level you out, you have no emotions.
They walk around like a zombie.
Yeah, I was never on antidepressants for depression. I get severe migraines. And so one of the meds, it's more of a muscle relaxer that
mm-hmm.
was created originally for depression. And they found it doesn't work for that. And I never took it regularly. I only took it when I had a headache as needed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I hated it because it just... I was here. You could tell me the world was going to end, and I had no motion, no care. I had to quit taking it when I had migraines just because of that. I just couldn't deal with that just being there.
You're there, but you're not in the moment.
Yeah.
It's not there.
You're just. It's almost like, and I'm going by what I've been told, because I am like never tried drugs. I've never had a care to. If you do it, that's your deal. Don't care. But, you know, from what I've heard, it's kind of like being stoned. You're just calm and there.
Yeah, they just, they call it stoned anyway.
Yeah. Well, that is my biggest issue with the world we live in now. As individuals, we look for the quick fix. We don't deal with our issues. We don't deal with things. We take a pill to make everything better.
Right. Not realizing they don't really do anything for better.
And what they're finding out is that faith-based therapies, faith-based life has a higher, it's a 76% higher success rate of overcoming what you're struggling with than just conventional therapy alone.
Sure. Of course it does. The academic world does not want to acknowledge that.
No.
They like to keep that under wraps. And a lot of that is from Big Pharma.
Oh, exactly. You know, the other thing is, you know, it's like the whole society. We're the more faith becomes a narrative in society, the more people come out and talk about their faith and come out and talk about, you know, their life and things like that, and really push the faith narrative, the more the fear mongering comes into play. You know, you look at different aspects of things, you know, the whole Gaza Strip and the, you know, Israeli fight in the Middle East. Why is it now such a big narrative? Why is the U.S. getting more involved in it now than ever before? You know, why is it, as society, we keep pushing this narrative of fear? You know, basically,
I was going to say, that's the only way to keep the people in check.
Yeah. You know, I believe in conspiracies in a sense, but I'm not one of those Alex Jones big conspiracy buffs, everything's a conspiracy. But, you know, I truly believe COVID was one giant social experiment. And it was an experiment of how you could control the masses and change the narrative of a society. And I truly believe Trump saw into that, which is why he relinquished his powers of controlling things and said, here, each state has their own control. You figure it out and you deal with it. He wasn't going to be a part of it. And ever since then, if you look at it, it was COVID, COVID, COVID. Well, people started wising up to COVID. Now it's something else and something else and it's something else.
Yeah.
Now, there's always something constantly to cause that influx and fighting among people, but also to keep that fear, to keep us at bay and control the narrative.
Mm-hmm. Now think about this. It's a, in the military, I call it a distraction. In the military, what's the military do to make the enemy think they're going to do something different?
One, we release bogus information to the media.
Which is?
I like to call it the Trojan horse.
A distraction.
Yeah.
Tactical, tactical way of keeping the enemy's eyes on something other than your prime objective. Now I'm gonna ask you a question here. What was the largest naval assault in World War II?
The largest naval assault in World War II?
Yeah.
I don't remember what the battle was, but wasn't it in the Philippines?
Mm-mm. Well, it was in the Pacific, yeah. It was the Battle of Okinawa.
Okay.
And everybody thinks, oh, it was D-Day, Normandy. No.
Normandy was the most casualties, but it wasn't the largest battle or assault.
It wasn't the largest naval assault.
Correct. But we had more casualties in general in Normandy than any other battle. And the big reason to that, and I'm not saying it's by just military, a lot of civilians, only because, like the Kinder train was bombed, and that was a train full of children going to England.
Mm-hmm.
Because England had a deal with the Jewish people, we'll take your children to protect them, to keep your line alive. And so families, hundreds and hundreds of families, put their kids on trains and shipped them to England. And that train got bombed, and only 6 people out of hundreds of children survived. I was fortunate to meet a gentleman who was a survivor of that train.
Wow.
He was on, we did an interview with him on the radio show, and he was 4 or 5. They're not quite sure how exactly how old he was, He remembers a little bit of it, but not much.
Mm-hmm.
But he was brought over his tag. So what they did is they put pinned tags on each of the kids so they could know who's what their names are and who they are.
Mm-hmm.
And he survived, but his tag came off, and they picked one off the ground and put it on him. So they're not quite sure who he is. And he was brought over by soldiers to the U.S. And it's a really cool story. His name is Peter Hegseth, or Peter Hadley, sorry. Peter Hadley. And his parents were the oldest, and granted, they were only 40 at the time. But back then, people over 35 were not allowed to adopt because the age of death was not like it is now. And so they fought and won. They are actually the oldest people allowed to adopt a child.
Hmm.
And he talks a little bit about it, what he remembers, and he talks about, you know, what he has been told and the stories that were written about him. And he did a DNA test his kids conned him into doing a DNA test to see if they could figure out where he came from, who his family lineage is, and there's
mm-hmm.
none left. So far, no one's of his lineage or his genetics have done a DNA test. So they don't know if they just haven't done one or if his bloodline is not, he's the last of his line. But the Battle of Okinawa, I don't know if you've noticed this a lot, but there isn't a lot of details about a lot of our battles with Japan.
Yeah.
It's like one of the best kept secrets.
Well, the Battle of Okinawa is called Touchstone to Victory. It was only supposed to be a couple of days, so the Americans thought. Turned out to be a couple of months. Who was in the middle of it? The Okinawan citizens. Yeah. It's interesting.
It is. You know, the thing is, I understand their viewpoint in one way. I'll explain more in a minute. But I still have a hard time being okay with it. So I grew up with my neighbor she's from Japan. And she's
mm-hmm.
a war bride brought over. And she became a translator of Japanese. And she worked for 3M and Unisys, two major companies. She ended up, went from rags to riches. But she gave everything back. I mean, she created orphanages here and there. She brought the kids over here. I mean, she's a phenomenal, very faith-based woman that did everything for everybody else, including me and, you know, my brother and sister growing up. But, you know, she had a condo that you timeshared out in Hawaii, and we got to go for our my 16th birthday. And when we went to Pearl Harbor, that is a big tourist destination and a big education destination for the Japanese. And I understand their viewpoint, but I have a hard time with it because they look at it as the greatest battle they want. And they look at it as a big hurrah and disrespectful, I guess, by our standards.
I guess it depends on who you talk to.
Right, and that's the thing, you know, when I was a kid, you know, I had family in Pearl Harbor, so, you know, and you're American, so, you know, it's a tragedy. But, you know, as I got older and got, you know, seeing both sides of every, you know, of life, you know, that's where I say I understand where they're coming from. You know, to them, that was the biggest victory they ever fell upon them, in a way. You know, it was a sneak attack on the U.S. So I guess, in a way, yeah, they should celebrate it.
Well, our Pearl Harbor Day is December 7th. Their Pearl Harbor Day is December the 8th.
Correct. But that's because of the international dateline and time. Because when it happened here was, you know, people look at it and like, what? And I go, do you not understand they're tomorrow? Are today and they're tomorrow?
But there was an interview when a survivor, this is many, many years ago, survivor of the Arizona and one of the bomber pilots that flew over the Arizona dropping these bombs. And they were sitting together at the memorial of the Arizona, and the bomber pilot had tears in his eyes, and he said, I'm so sorry. So those who celebrate it as a large victory, that's on them. But those who regret what they did, that's, you know, that's saying something.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I got a lot of regrets.
I think we all do.
Yeah.
That have been put in that position. I think the part that bugs me the most about Pearl Harbor is now it's turned into this whole big conspiracy theory about how it could have been prevented and how, you know, it was an inside job by Roosevelt to bring us into the war that he never wanted us to go into to begin with. And they're like, they don't look at communication that was there compared to now. No, they don't look at, you know, we were in peacetime. We were not at an alert status. I mean, it's like that ship, I can't remember what it was called, that was attacked in Yemen before 9/11. The Coleman.
Oh, the Coleman,
You know, granted, yes, the guys were at fault for that happening because, you know, even though we were in peacetime, we were in a foreign dock and they should have been all, you know, aimed and ready and, you know, paying attention. But, you know, and that's hindsight. But the thing is we were in peacetime. You don't live at this highest state, a high level of attack and awareness all the time. If you haven't experienced that before. You know, we've never been attacked on our own soil since the Revolutionary War. And then it wasn't even our own soil. It was, you know, owned by the English and the British. Well, I really believe we need to stop looking at life that happens back then through modern eyes. We need to look at what they thought, what they went through, what technology, what things were like back then to understand things from that perspective.
Yeah. I agree.
You know, it's like the whole slavery thing. They're actually finding out that slaves were brought over here way before American settlers were brought over here. Down in Florida and down off of that, the Gulf area. And I'm having a really hard time with history with my kids. They're not teaching, you know, what these people do. Like one of the questions on my daughter's class, she's in third grade, was, who was Betsy Ross? And so we all know Betsy Ross is the woman that sold the first flag, American flag. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Their answer in her assignment was a woman who sewed for a living. That was the answer to the question. And I'm looking at it and I'm like,
yeah.
I'm like, this is so morally wrong on so many different levels. Go, this is the 1700s. Almost all women sewed. If it wasn't for this woman, we would never have had the American flag.
True.
I mean, they are literally dumbing down and not even giving our ancestors the credit for what they did. They're literally dumbing it down to, like, Rosa Parks sat on a bus.
You did a lot more than that.
Like, this is nuts. You know, Eli Whitney figured out a better way to pick cotton. It's like, no. I mean, yes, but no.
He was an inventor.
Yeah.
Come on.
You know, I mean, just the way that we're dumbing down, you know, our history. You know, Harriet Tubman and how they dumbed her down. It's like, seriously. What is really cool is a friend of mine does history.
Mm-hmm.
She helps trace back your history, your family heritage. And she's really getting into the historical aspect of it. And she got to meet Harriet Tubman's great-granddaughter, great-great-granddaughter, something like that, a descendant
mm-hmm.
of Harriet
yeah.
Tubman. And they were going through the attic of her family's house.
Mm-hmm.
And they just found a rough draft of a letter that was written to Frederick Douglass about a newspaper article that was coming out written by Harriet Tubman to Frederick Douglass.
Wow.
And it's been authenticated and everything else, and it's being put in the Harriet Tubman Museum in Buffalo, New York.
Cool.
I love looking at old postcards and old letters because it shows what people were thinking beyond just the headlines. It'll get you a view of that actual person.
Yeah, that's why I like reading Civil War letters. Some of them are pretty hard to read, but some of them you can make out.
Mm-hmm. I know we just found out yesterday. So where I live, there's an orphanage in the town next to us. And it was one of the largest orphanages in the state of Minnesota at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a book written about it. And a lot of bad things happened in that orphanage, which happened to a lot of orphanages back in the day. But
right.
There's a book written about it that actually has part of my husband's family in there. And he didn't even know it because of stuff that's not talked about in his family.
Hmm.
He has no idea where he came from. He doesn't know much about his ancestors or his history. And I'm thankful every day that my grandma talked to us about where we came from and passed it down to us. I'm thankful I listened to her when she talked.
Yeah. Too bad you didn't. Did you take notes?
I've written it down over time. I know that half my family fought in World War II on the American side, and I know half of us fought on the Nazi side. And I know I get a lot of slack for this, but I believe that when we did the Nuremberg trials, that all the people in charge should have been punished for what they did. But I don't believe that all the peon soldiers, the privates, all the lower class soldiers should have been punished for what they did because they're following orders. And if you didn't follow orders, you were killed and your family was killed.
Yeah.
You know, here you do something wrong, you get punished. Your whole family don't get punished. Over there, they took your whole family out. It was like the mafia.
Yeah.
You know.
Or the Praetorian Guard.
Yeah. And they knew how to soldiers in line. So I don't believe that a lot of these young guys should have been punished for doing what they're told to do to protect themselves and their families. a lot of them live with the guilt. They still do.
Mm-hmm.
But we are out of time for today.
Uh-huh. How quickly it goes.
Doesn't it? So join us today at noon for Hometown Heroes, and we have a returning guest today, Mr. Ira Smith, who was a pro wrestler and turned his life around and is a big advocate of faith, struggled with addiction, and now wrote a book, best-selling author, but also is a big advocate for adoption and foster. And he calls it, his house is the UN, because he adopts, he opened his door to foster kids and ended up adopting all of them.
Cool. Wow.
So stay tuned at noon for his inspirational story again and adding more to his story. And listening to his life with the AWE and the WWF and all the fun things of back with Ric Flair and Hulk Hogan back in the day, the WCW. Wow. I'm a wrestling fan, so I was. Or what I call the man soap opera.
That's about the size of it.
Well, you know, a lot of people don't realize and know that Minnesota was a big hub for wrestling back in the day. A lot of the greats came from Minnesota here.
Yep.
So have a good day, have a good night, and we'll see you back here next Monday.
Sounds like a plan.
Bye for now.
See you all later.